Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome. I'm Diane Lees. Thank you for joining me this evening. Spring is definitely showing itself here in Northeast Ohio, although there seem to have been some nasty weather systems pummeling the U.S. this week. So riding was a little bit treacherous in between lightning strikes and booming thunder. Not so much in Europe, though, as spring bike racing is in full bloom. And even though cycling has had its share of bad press over the past few months, this past week was cause for celebration with the 111th running of Paris-Roubaix. Plenty of mishaps as the cobbles toppled participants in several places of the 245-plus kilometer course. But Fabian Cancellara took his third victory, barely sprinting past Belgium's Sepp van Marck in the final straight of the Roubaix Velodrome in the last 3 seconds of the race. What was even more remarkable was that the weather was neither wet nor cold. But there was a lot of dust and a lot of flat tires. It's always interesting to me to see the neutral support, the Mavic motorcycles with the big wheels on the back, and they needed plenty of them for this race. Unfortunately, I went to Twitter about 15 minutes before the end of the race, and immediately somebody was posting who the winner was. I was watching it on NBC Sports, which obviously had a delay, which didn't make me happy. But it was a great race. It was great to see it on TV, and it was a thrilling finish. So while Paris-Roubaix is perhaps the most famous of the one-day races, the Giro d'Italia, which begins May 4th this year, is right there at the top of the European stage events. And to date, the only American to win that race was Andy Hampston in 1988. Andy's racing career spanned 10 years, riding with other luminaries such as Bernard Hinault and Greg LeMond on teams like Lavie Claire and 7-Eleven. He has many wins in his column and is considered one of the gentlemen of our sport. Today, Andy and his brother Steve own and operate Hampston Cycles, a custom frame shop in Seattle. And in addition, Andy, who lives in Europe for a good part of the year, also offers tours of Italy with his company, Cingaglie, which I hope I'm saying right. We'll be able to ask him because Andy is our guest this evening. He tours in the summer season with his riders out in about four events that they do over a period of months. He's at home right now in Boulder, and to my great delight, we're going to talk to him in the first half of the show. Then I'm going to take a short break, bring you some current news, including a new Kickstarter program for a book by Red Kite Prayer's Patrick Brady, and we'll scurry right back to Colorado to welcome my second guest, who is one of the most read and listened to tech gurus of our sport. Leonard Zinn is well respected for his ideas about bikes, cranks, and pretty much everything that has to do with maintaining your bicycle. The fourth edition of Zinn and the Art of Road Bike Maintenance has just been released by Velo Press, and we'll talk with Leonard about his new book, his ideas about crank length, which is always interesting to me, and what he thinks about all this newfangled electronic shifting stuff. So let's get right to it, and I am so honored to welcome Andy Hampston to The Outspoken Cyclist. Andy, thanks for joining me this evening.
Thanks, Diane. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it is my privilege. Last time I saw you, you were like ducking, thinking I was going to hit you with my iPad instead of take a picture at NAS.
Oh, dear. That's right. One of those technology things.
Yes. So it's fitting we're able to talk just after Paris-Roubaix and before the Giro, and I want to talk about racing. But let me talk with you about your early days, because I know you're from Columbus, Ohio. Then you moved to North Dakota. What was it like growing up in North Dakota?
cold.
Okay.
Then around May, it got pretty nice. But it was pretty good. My siblings and I had the gift of boredom growing up in North Dakota. So now none of us live there, even though it's a wonderful place, but we've all moved to pretty much wherever we want to be. And right now I'm in the banana belt here in Boulder, Colorado.
The banana belt. I always consider it the Republic of Boulder. I've heard that. Right?
Oh, you'll hear a lot. Yeah. It's a moving target.
So your brother Steve and you are both into cycling. Are other siblings into cycling? How many siblings are there?
There's five of us. My sister Sarah, she rides a little bit, lives in West Virginia. Her husband and sons are really into cycling, mostly touring. One son did some mountain bike racing and is doing a lot of road riding now, so he is the bug. And my brother David lives in Portland, Oregon, where some people like to ride bicycles.
Yeah, a few.
He is a person that does not own a car, rides his bike everywhere. And actually, when the mayor had his state of the city address, had a 3-minute video on my little brother and how much help he's done promoting bike paths and sidewalks in his under-recognized neighborhood in East Portland. Wow. So the bug goes pretty deep through the family.
Well, we call it here the bicycle gene. You know, it's just something in your DNA that says bicycle. I'm not sure what that
probably
is.
What's the rest of the behavioral argument? It's either learned or I forget.
Nature, nurture.
My mom didn't drive. She took all five kids to doctor's appointments on her bike. We had a car. My dad would drive, but she dragged us all over on bikes. So I would rather be on a bicycle than in a car any day.
Oh, me too. It's just difficult to get around Cleveland. It was not built for cycling, unfortunately. It really was not. So when did you start actually going from riding to racing?
I was pretty young. I think I did a few races as soon as I started riding at, I must have been 13 years old, in the American Amateur Bicycle League of America. That's how far back it goes. So that's either 76 or 77.
Yeah, ABLA, that's right.
Those first few years, I would race a few times a year. And then when I was 15, my family spent the summer in England where we visited relatives. And then I really found out about racing with just the local club in Cambridge, England. And I would do weekly time trials and a few criteriums. And more importantly, read about, you know, hang out with a lot of other cyclists, but read about racing, learned about the Tour de France and professional racing. And, you know, that sparked a very large corner of my imagination that one could actually just ride their bike and people, including maybe their parents, would leave them alone to do it.
It happened. It happened for you.
Except my mom's asking when I'm going to go back to school, so I'm not completely off the hook.
Your mom?
Yes.
She's still asking that?
Yeah, she still said, you said you'd leave school and get this cycling out of your bug. So when are you going back to school?
Okay, that's funny. That is hilarious. It's also awesome in a way. So I want to talk to you about the years that you were a pro in the 80s and 90s. Everything I've ever read, everything I know about you is that you were the gentleman racer. But you were aggressive enough to post a lot of wins and high finishes. Do you think of yourself, as everybody said, that you were a good all-around rider? Or do you feel you had
a points on everything you said? There's plenty of my competitors who didn't think I was a nice guy, but you know, that's racing. I was a climber. I did well in quite a few time trials, but not long flat time trials, especially in the Tour. You know, and I could usually stay out of trouble, and you know, my 7-Eleven Motorola teams were really devoted to helping me on the flat stages in the important stage races. So, you know, I had a lot of very good help when, you know, to overcome my lack of power on the flats. You know, so I wouldn't say I'm an all-rounder, but I did well in mountainous stage races.
What was it like competing in Europe and being an American and winning among all those Europeans? I mean, that was the early days of Americans in Europe.
Yeah, it was, I mean, obviously it was very fun to do. I didn't have a lot of pressure on me like a very good Italian would going into the Tour of Italy. I wasn't unknown. I'd won the Tour of Switzerland the 2 years previously. All my competitors knew to keep an eye on me. But I didn't to broaden that question, the Giro is so much more fun than the Tour de France for me, probably for most bike racers, because there's only 5 or 6 hours of stress. You just get on the bike, go as hard as you can, as fast as you can. The mountains, you know, in those years, that year it was pretty hard. Some years it wasn't as hard as the Tour. But it was really easy as a foreigner to relax after the races. We had a very good support team. Our doctor, Max Testa, was Italian, and he could call the hotels a day or two ahead of time and tell them to just serve whatever food they were really proud of instead of, you know, the meat or chicken or fish that the formula from the race organizers told them to serve us. So it was fun. I knew the racers well. I raced in Italy quite a bit. I really loved racing there. Mike Neal was our coach, and he, you know, he cut his teeth in Italy, so he knew what was happening behind the scenes. He knew who to talk to get good information on courses. And I was, you know, in 1988, I was in good form. I just wanted to go hunting, as we call it, at the Giro. And everything fell into place really well.
So you raced in other pretty exalted company, Greg LeMond and Bernardino. What was the Peloton like then, and do you think you can make comparisons to it now? I mean, what has changed most to you when you watch? And I imagine you still watch racing today, yes?
Yeah, I follow it. I haven't been to a race. I haven't followed racers. I think I'll go watch a little bit of the Giro this year. And that's a very good question, and I better try to sound intelligent and say, I don't know, because it's completely different. However, my belief is Bernardino would mop the floor with today's racers.
Really?
Just because he told me he would. We had a really good conversation this last fall, and I was able to ask him a lot of questions that I've been wondering about. But he said it's so unimaginative with the radios. And I guess I was talking about the Sky tactics and how I happened to see a little web interview with my ex-teammate Sean Yates, who was answering a question about, hey, you know, your first and second, are you going to use your second place man Froome to go on the attack and put everyone on the defensive? And his reply was, no, we have a plan, we have a formula. This isn't the 1980s, and we're not Bernard freaking Hinault.
Really?
It was just the most, as a fan, it was the most disappointing thing I could possibly hear. So I mentioned that to Hinault, and he said, the racers today in general are so uncreative. You know, that they look at, especially the Sky team, to pick on them a little bit, they look at their, I guess, their out, you know, horsepower output or watts or whatever they're doing, and make their tactical calls on numbers. And Hinault just figured he would destroy these guys right now. And I agree with him.
I'm talking with Andy Hampston, who is blowing my mind with some of the things he's saying, but it's just so interesting. He's in Boulder, Colorado, but I'm sure he's heading over to Europe pretty soon. Was there ever an event, Andy, that you wanted to win and didn't?
Well, the Tour de France, as Bob calls it.
As who calls it?
Bob Roll.
Oh, that's right.
Unknown teammate of mine. that was the race I had always focused on. And I realized towards the end of my career, maybe I should have spread that energy around a little bit, but it worked well. You know, I physically, I have a hard time getting to a really high peak, or certainly trying to get a couple in a year. So trying to, you know, be smart and win a one-day race in the fall that maybe other people weren't as focused on just didn't work for me physiologically. I did well in hot weather, and, you know, I don't have a big engine, but I was able to recuperate really well. So hot, mountainous, 3-week stage races made a lot of sense to me. I love doing the Giro. But the tour is what I was always trying to win.
Yeah, unfortunately, only one person a year can win it, you know?
And all these other guys wanted to win it. It was really weird. It was,
why was that?
Such a hurry. Yeah.
So I want to talk about your touring company, because I know you love food and you love wine and you love riding. And what could be better than doing all three in Italy?
Yeah, and that's... I have to give my mom credit for that. I sound like such a mama's boy in this interview, but she's the smart and the tough one in the family. She came over towards the end, I guess, in the winter going into my last year as a racer. And, you know, I knew I'd stop. My daughter was about to be born and, you know, do one more year and move on and do something else. So she asked me, well, what will you do? And I was living in Tuscany then. And I said, oh, I don't know, nothing for a while. But, you know, I'm interested in wine. You know, I don't know much about it, but the little farm I had a very nice small vineyard and old olive trees. And she said, well, then let's talk about what you think you'll be doing. So we just brainstormed a little bit. And I said, well, what I really like doing is, you know, when friends and family come over and I'm not racing in the off season, just cruising around Tuscany, you know, whether in the car or a bike, you know, I'm thinking of, you know, there's a lot of people that do, a lot of companies that do bike tours, but I really like it. And I know people, I know roads, I know, you know, quite a bit about the culture, which in Tuscany, you can imagine, usually comes down to food and wine. So she really encouraged me to look into it. And in 97, I, you know, had 1 year off and I also wanted to relax and, you know, not just jump into something right away, but I really like riding my bike, and riding my bike with other people without a race going on. It's so relaxing. It's so much fun working with people on vacation. So I started Cinghiale Bike Tours, which Cinghiale, so hard to pronounce, impossible to spell, but it means wild boar. And they're, you know, Italy has no top predators, so they might be the top predator, but they're absolutely delicious and they wander around doing whatever they want, eating whatever they want. So I thought I'd name my little company after the local animals. And it's really fun. It's, you know, we do usually five trips a year in the spring and fall, mostly in Tuscany, but also in the mountains in the Dolomites or even the French Alps. We go to the Barolo area. It's oddly enough, everywhere we go, there's usually wine, really good wine growing there. You know, we ask our clients to be pretty fit, and we ride on the quiet roads that go over the hills instead of along the valleys. And it is really fun working, you know, as work, riding with other people on vacation that love riding and eating and probably wine.
So how many people typically sign up for one of your tours? My hand's up, by the way. Do I have to ride? Can my partner ride and he can go ride and I can just eat and drink?
Absolutely. We actually have one trip for people who don't have any interest in riding, but maybe their spouse does. So we have cooking lessons with a very, very nice woman who, you know, she's a great cook, but she's an architect. She's not, you know, we have cooking lessons in her house for the people who don't ride. And the rest of us get hungry and get back in time to have lunch and eat what the cooks made. Most of the trips are, I have to tell people, you know, sometimes I have to calm people down who have a big race coming up a week or two afterwards, that it's not a hammer session. There's, in my mind, there's little reason to fly all the way to Italy, even though it's the best riding anywhere, and just ride your bike. So it's about half the fun is riding and half the fun is in the afternoon. We'll do either a cooking lesson for everyone, or we'll go to a winery and talk to the farmer about, you know, how wine is made in the field, not with secret formulas in the cellar. We go to an olive mill. You get the idea. It's something to do with food and wine. And then the next day, ride our bikes and get hungry and thirsty again.
Exactly. Eat to ride, ride to eat. I got it. Yeah. That is awesome. So when do your tours actually start? You're here in the States. You must be getting ready to go to Europe.
Yeah, in early May, my wife and little boy and I will go over. We'll go a little early, and we're going to go to southern Italy and scout out a possible route down in across the sort of the arch of the foot, if you look at Italy as a big boot.
Right.
And then at the end of May into early June, we'll do a trip in the Piedmont area around the Barolo winemaking area. And then another trip in our village along the Tuscan coast in Castagneto. And then in the fall, the end of August, we'll go into the Dolomites and just ride as many fantastic passes as we possibly can. And then back to Tuscany in September for two more trips.
So when do you actually come back? I mean, you're here now. How long do you spend in the States? How long do you spend in Europe?
Yeah, it's about 9 months of the year. Okay. We're in America, just because my daughter is in high school. Another year and a half, she'll be away in college. And we'll spend a little more, you know, we'll probably spend half the year in Italy.
So you own your own place in Italy?
Yes, I owned a little farm, and then I got smart and bought a little apartment.
Aha.
And I don't weed whack for weeks and weeks when I show up. I'm really happy buying other people's olive oil and wine. And
okay, so when you go on the tours, then you stay at other places. Are you staying in hotels? Or are you staying in villas? Where are you staying?
We stay in hotels or inns that I select by the restaurant, which is usually helps out to select where they stay. You know, really nice, clean rooms, 3-4 stars. There's not a real big difference, I find. But more and more, it's almost always family run. You know, grandma's in the kitchen, or at least it's her recipes. And, you know, typical one story that my home village, there's an ex-professional racer from the 50s and 60s, bought a little restaurant, and then in the 90s was, you know, took out a big loan and made a 23-room hotel. It is so much fun. They understand, you know, what bike riders need to eat, and we might come in late for lunch. And a lot of the other places I look for, especially in Chianti, there's a lot of, I guess I'd have to call it a hamlet. You know, maybe it was a big farm that has half a dozen buildings. Most of them were apartments for the families that live there. And now it's been converted to a hotel, but it might not be categorized as a hotel because they don't want to pay the enormous fee for that. So it's an inn, often without a restaurant, but they'll have a professional kitchen and bring locals in to cook for groups like mine. So there's not a TV in every room. And nobody cares.
Exactly. Hopefully you're too full and too tired.
Yes.
So all of this stuff about Italy and riding and food and wine, and it's just so interesting and sounds so like so much fun. Do you ever see a time when cycling in this country, the U.S., will ever be as romantic and exciting as it seems to be in Europe?
Yes. I mean, I think that's now. I'm noticing, I mean, sorry, but you mentioned romance. 10 years ago, there were no women riding bikes in Italy. That there'd be a racer blasting away. Every third day, I would see a woman in a group ride.
Wow.
You know, now it's about 10 to 15%. In America, it's, I don't know, it's half, right? But certainly in my neighborhood, middle of the week, out on a ride, it's more women than men.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that's
and,
Boulder.
You know, there's the freaky Boulder Republic.
True.
But, you know, not a large percentage of our U.S. population, but it's a really good cross-section of people. You know, it's the racers are mostly, you know, men and masters. But it must be 30 or 40% women. And you tell me if I'm completely off on
that. Well,
this.
It depends on the location, I think. You know, here in Cleveland, and it's true, women are riding more all over the country. So you're saying in Italy there aren't not that many women, and there are more here in the U.S., and so that's more romantic. I guess for men that's more romantic.
Well, I'm trying to be cute with the romance part of that. But it's there's things about America in cycling that are better than Europe. And I know that may not sound like it makes much sense. For instance, you know, I was able to race, you know, I grew up in North Dakota. There were half a dozen racers, but, you know, I caught the bug, learned about it, ended up being a bike racer and ended up being a pro bike racer in Italy, which seems like it beats all odds. But there were a lot of times racing in Italy, in Europe, that it helped that I didn't have an ex-pro uncle telling me everything, like most of the, you know, Italian and French and Belgian racers seem to have, because they were always told, I mean, they were nourished and nurtured to become bike racers, but they didn't know anything else.
Right.
While most of the American kids, we really had to work hard at being a racer. So when we had an opportunity, we really made the most of it. You know, it's a huge flight over. You know, until I was an established pro, I just figured, wow, this might be my last chance to ever make it as a pro racer in Italy. I'd better do something today, even though I may not feel very good. So I think that it was an advantage not coming from a strong cycling background for me personally to make it, you know, way back in the 80s, racing in Europe. So that's less important than European racers. When they come to America, they love it because the crowds are really young and excited and vocal and very encouraging. So there's a lot of things about the American bike racing scene that's better than Europe. You know, we have cornered marshals that sweep the gravel off of corners. That
True.
Never happens in Europe.
True, I can imagine.
It's just ridiculous. Right, you know, it's part of the course.
Right.
You know, we didn't do it 100 years ago. Why would we do it today?
True.
So there's a lot of improvements that come in the racing world that trickle down into the cycling world. You know, I still look to Europe myself as, you know, kind of, it has the great tradition. It has all the, you know, really wonderful races. You know, when we have a tour of Colorado or California, it's absolutely fantastic. But, you know, I love the Tour de France and Paris-Roubaix because they've been around for 100 years of misery.
Well, you know, I wish we could just talk all day. It's so much fun. And you were fun when I met you at NABS. You're fun now. I met your brother. He's fun, too. We're going to talk to him about Hampston Bikes. Are you involved in that?
Yes. He runs everything. I fit quite a few people. A lot of them come on my tours. And also I design, and I'm using my fingers as quotation. I'll grumble about, hey, I want to ride on gravel roads. Rah, rah, rah. Why don't we make road bikes for gravel roads? And that's how the Strada Bianca came about. But all the real brain power and all the brawn comes from Stephen Hampston.
And he is a character, too, just like his brother Andy.
No, he's the funny one, according to
I don't know. You did pretty well. Well, you know, this has been a lot of fun, and I really enjoy talking with you. Maybe what I'll do is I'll come to Italy and ride with you guys. Well, at least I'll eat with you guys and drink with you guys. That would be so much fun.
That is the best.
Well, you have been an awesome guest, and thank you so much. And have a great night, and enjoy your summer in Italy.
Thank you, Diane.
All right.
Happy ride, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Former pro racer Andy Hampston joined me from his home in Boulder, Colorado. He's getting ready to head over to Italy to conduct all his summer tours. What a pleasure. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
More than 100 million wild animals are killed each year illegally. Poaching is a major threat to our country's wildlife. I'm Tom Barry. I'm an actor with a desire to preserve living space for wildlife. The Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust does just that. worked with private landowners to protect wildlife, to preserve natural habitats. To learn more or to work with the Humane Society Wildlife Land Trust, call 800-729-SAVE. That's 800-729-SAVE or visit wildlifelandtrust.org. Thank you.
We're back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Lees, and I have some news for you for the week. This comes from the Daytona Beach News Journal by Lydia Longa, who's a staff writer. It seems that Kelly Davis was intent on riding her bicycle to a job interview this past Tuesday morning, despite her sister's offer to give her a ride to the highly anticipated appointment. Davis, the 32-year-old mother of a 10-year-old boy, told her siblings she wanted to lose weight and riding the bike would give her the exercise she wanted. Tuesday afternoon, as she held her newborn daughter, Davis's sister Karen Knight cried inconsolably as she stood just a few feet from where Davis had just been killed by a large beer truck at Belleville Road and South Ridgewood Avenue. Police said Davis was heading east on Belleville and crossed into the path of the Bud Light rig driven by 35-year-old Michael Cotton. She disregarded the truck, said Daytona Beach Police Lieutenant Major Garvin. The truck driver had the green light. While the preliminary investigation shows Cotton was not at fault, he was taken to Halifax Health Medical Center to have his blood drawn, as is routine in fatal crashes, Garvin said. He was very distraught. Davis is the fourth bicyclist killed this year in Volusia County, while Flagler County has had one death so far, and a bicyclist in Flagler County was critically injured on Monday morning. I cannot tell you how many of these stories come across my screen every week. It is just so sad. And it would be nice to see some changes. This was posted, it's a blog entry from an attorney named Stephen M. Gersten. He was named Michigan's Lawyer of the Year. His firm specializes in auto accidents. And he wrote a blog that there is bias against cyclists, and it's rampant and unfair. According to the Boston Globe, the name of the article they wrote was All About Bias Against Cyclists, and it started by questioning whether a grand jury recently failed to serve an indictment against a driver suspected of vehicular homicide in the death of 41-year-old Alexander Motsenagos last summer. According to the article, quote, many accidents involving bicyclists and motor vehicles can be traced to road design, inclement weather, or attention lapse. But law enforcement traced Monsenegos' death to truck driver Dana McComb, a man with an extensive history of driving infractions who fled the scene after striking the Wellesley cyclist from the side. Witness statements, video footage, and subsequent police analysis of the scene suggested that the deadly collision was more than an unavoidable accident. And so the article goes on to talk about how this man, who was 83 years old when he was hit and killed on his bicycle, was not worthy of an indictment because, A, he was too old to ride a bicycle, which, of course, none of us would agree with, and that bicyclists aren't worthy of riding on the road. They should not be riding on the road. If you are interested in this article, as I said, it's quite long, but you can go to Stephen M. Gersten, G-U-R-S-T-E-M, and his firm, again, specializes in auto accidents, but in this case, he is all for the cyclist and hopes to make some changes in how juries and how prosecutors treat cyclists who have been hit, which I thought was very cool, very cool. So if anybody knows about USA Cycling Rule 1.2.019, it does not allow racers to race unsanctioned events, and the organization was trying to enforce that rule this year. Well, there's an update on that. From Colorado Springs on the 11th, after engaging in dialogue with USA Cycling to address the immediate concerns raised by the enforcement of UCI Rule 1.2.019, the UCI issued the following statement. The UCI listened to the feedback from the various groups involved and who feel affected by a strict and immediate enforcement of Rule 1.2.019 and its associated sanctions. The UCI has decided to postpone strict enforcement of the rule in 2013 with the expectation that all stakeholders, national federations, race directors, teams, and riders will discuss and do what is necessary to prepare for the rule's full enforcement in 2014. Notwithstanding the fact that the rule 1.2.019 has been enforced in Europe for many years. It is clear strict enforcement in the U.S. and other countries will have unintended and undesirable consequences, said Steve Johnson, USA Cycling President and CEO. So stay tuned. It should be interesting. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, my friend Patrick Brady, affectionately known by those who read his blog, Red Kite Prayer, and many others as Padraig, has launched a Kickstarter campaign to fund a new book he is writing titled Why We Ride. The book is a collection of his best writing on cycling and the cycling life. There are 2 weeks left in the campaign. If you are interested in knowing about it, you can go to Kickstarter.com. And finally, a couple of events, both national and worldwide, that are coming up for your cycling enjoyment. Once again, the National Bike Challenge from Endemondo begins May 1st, runs through September 30th. Log in, log your miles, register with a team, or just watch your milestones as you ride your bike all spring and summer. It's nationalbikechallenge.org. And Cyclofem, which is an annual event for women, will happen on Mother's Day, May 12th. Cyclofem is a global women's cycling day created to honor the past, to celebrate the present, and to empower the future of women in cycling and the opportunity for positive social change. It's Cyclofem, CycloFemme.com. And you do not have to be a girl to join one of the rides. So that's all the news I have. We're going to skedaddle over to Boulder, Colorado, and check in with tech guru Leonard Zinn. Leonard, thanks for joining me on the show this evening.
Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So we're going to talk about your new book, Zinn and the Art of Road Bike Maintenance, the fourth edition. But I think our listeners would be interested in a little bit of your background. I know you have a degree in physics. But tell us a little bit about where you grew up and how you got into the bicycle business to begin with.
I grew up in Los Alamos, New Mexico, which that's the biggest reason I have a degree in physics. It just never occurred to me to do anything else because that's, everybody's dad essentially in Los Alamos has a PhD in physics.
Interesting.
And it's the Los Alamos National Laboratory where the atomic bomb was made and stuff. And it's incredible bike riding there as well as great skiing, climbing, everything, every kind of outdoor thing you could imagine is great there. And so I grew up doing all that sort of stuff. And, a short story is I was at Colorado College, was on the Alpine ski team, injured my knee, took up cycling to rehab that. By the time I graduated from college, I was on national cycling team, which by coincidence is in Colorado Springs, just like Colorado College is. So after I graduated, I essentially just had to move across town. And then I got an injury in the Tour of Ireland in 1981. And actually, while I was there, I actually did build one bike using the equipment at the Olympic Training Center for my wife. She wasn't my wife at the time, but she is now my wife of 30 years. And so I had that experience. But then in the Tour of Ireland in 1981, I tore the gastrocnemius muscle in my left leg. And it calcified. It kind of grew back as bone. And during that long rehab process, I kind of didn't know what to do with myself because I was just racing bikes. And so I ended up in Northern California and after getting laid off from a geophysics job, I started working for Tom Ritchie and building Ritchie mountain bikes. And that's really where I learned the trade. And then my knee continued to not get any better out there. And I could come back here and get treated by Andy Pruitt in Boulder. So I did that. And then about the same time, my grandmother died and left me $10,000. So I just used that to start Zinn Cycles. And that was about March 82. I've been doing it ever since.
Wow, what a great story. I mean, I'm sorry that your grandmother died, but I am happy that you got $10,000 and started Zinn Cycles. That is very, very cool story. I like that. I think our listeners will like that too. So how did you go from Tom Ritchie and building bikes back to Colorado with Andy Pruitt? And of course, I understand the rehab and all the work that he does into the kind of technical sort of question answer kind of stuff you do, and then working with maintenance and then writing these books. So what was that progression to bring us to probably the most popular maintenance book today?
Yeah, well, I was just building bike frames from about 82 to about 87-ish, something like that. And then somewhere in that time frame, a friend of mine had gone to Colorado College with John Windsor, bought a couple of local free magazines and combined them into something called Rocky Mountain Sports and Fitness, and was trying to get bicycle advertising in it. So he wanted bicycle content. So he wanted some tech articles for me, and he knew me from Colorado College, knew I could write because, you know, Colorado College is a liberal arts college. You kind of got to learn how to write.
Yep.
And so I started doing that for him. And then Felix McGowan was an old teammate of mine on a team in Colorado Springs, and he and some other people bought Velo News in 1989, and Velo News had existed since 1972, and it was just strictly a racing magazine with not much advertising, and they wanted to make more money from it. And one of the things that makes money in bike publications is technical articles. So, and he'd seen my writing in Rocky Mountain Sports and Fitness, and he knew me from the team. So he asked me to write some articles for Velo News, and now I'm the longest surviving person on the masthead. I've been, you know, at Velo News since 89, and that, you know, has involved constantly keeping up to date on whatever the latest equipment is and riding it and testing it and working on it. And of course, with my business, we constantly have to assemble bikes. And so maintenance, bike repair, bike assembly, all that kind of stuff I'm doing constantly. And and there is sort of a funny story about how I actually wrote the book.
Okay, go ahead.
So the first book was Zen and the Art of Mountain Bike Maintenance, and I wrote that in 1995. But all through the early 90s, see, my wife is a school principal, but she was a teacher for decades, and she used to go into a place called Discount Books in Boulder. The guy there was a big fan of my work in Velo News, and every time she'd go in, he'd say, "Your husband's got to write a book, and he's got to call it Zen and the Art of Mountain Bike Maintenance." And I just kind of laugh. And then one time she went in there and he'd made up a dummy cover for her and gave it to her. And somehow just visualizing this cover, it sort of clicked like, geez, I could do that. And then, I just did. And Velo Press was the new publishing arm of Velo News, and they were eager to do it. And then that book's been very successful, and so it was natural to then do a road bike maintenance book as well.
So I have kind of a weird question, and that is, you know, technology, while it stays the same in some ways, is changing pretty quickly in others. How are you able to get all this stuff into these books? And, I mean, we're at the fourth edition of Zen and the Art of Road Bike Maintenance. It's just published. It's brand new. And it's fresh. Everything's new. How do you get it incorporated so quickly?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it certainly is beneficial that I do the work I do with Velo News, because it's in all of the product managers of the bike component company's best interest to keep me informed at the earliest possible time of what's new, and so I get to see it and try it and work with it earlier than really just about anybody.
Oh, that's true.
And so that's a key part of it. You know, if I were only a frame builder, you know, I'd get the, you know, to see it way down the road once it finally became available from distributors, and then I probably couldn't afford to always buy the newest stuff and try it. And this way, you know, I get to go try it wherever, at whatever event they're being introduced. So,
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Leonard Zinn. He's in Boulder, Colorado. His new edition of Zinn and the Art of Road Bike Maintenance is out from Velo Press. What do you think about all the new electronic stuff, all of the DI2 and the EPS and all this stuff coming out? SRAM's about the only one right now who doesn't have electronic, but who knows where that'll go. Are you using it? Are you recommending it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just building up another bike for myself with Campagnolo Record EPS on it. And we here at Zinn Cycles, we sell a lot of bikes with sometimes with Camp EPS, but mostly with Durace DI2 and Altegra DI2. As far as my own opinion about it, you know, I guess my opinion originally had been like, why do we need this? Shifting is really good and parts are really light and this is a little bit heavier. And it certainly adds a lot of complexity and expense to the bike. And do we really need that? And then when they introduced the Durace DI2 at the Ironman in Kona, that was my 25th wedding anniversary. I went over there with my wife for that. And so that must have been September or October. We're 5 years ago.
Okay.
We're celebrating our 30th anniversary this year. So anyway, I was just amazed at the front shifting. I mean, the rear shifting is quicker too, and especially like what Campy EPS has done with it, where you can just hold the button down, you could go through all 11 cogs in one direction or all 11 the other. That's something you just can't do with a cable actuated system. But the front shifting on all the systems is just so amazing. I remember going up these hills on Durace DI2 in Hawaii, and you could be sprinting up over the top of the hill out of the saddle and then just touch the button and it would shift as your hill was cresting. It would shift from the inner chainring to the outer chainring, and just you felt like you were getting an arm sling, you know, you just as the hill crested, and you immediately get, you know, a couple of bike lengths on the people you were riding with. And so after that, I thought, well, maybe I've just never tried that with the normal shifting, cable actuated shifting. But you know, I had a Durace bike, I had a SRAM Red bike, I had a Campy Record bike, and I would go out and try and make that shift, and there's no way, you
nope.
know, when
you're
sprinting out of the saddle, if you then force the front derailleur hard enough to make that shift under load like that from the inner chainring to the outer chainring, you first of all have to push so hard with your hand that you can't push as hard with your legs. You can't be yanking on the bars and just thrashing the bike around like you can, like you were before you started trying to do the shift. And so then as soon as that happens, your speed drops a little, and yeah, you can maybe make the shift, but by the time the chain gets up there, you're now over geared going slowly, and you're just, it's the opposite of what you want. So it's, there's just no comparison. And that and this bike that I'm putting together for myself right now is actually, you know, there's this really huge popularity of these kind of long gravel races.
Yep.
Days, and so this bike is actually a cyclocross bike that would be that. You know, I'm really into racing cyclocross, but all my cyclocross bikes are single chainring, and this one's going to be a double chainring, and I will be able to put, normal road chainring sizes on it. It's also got disc brakes, and put normal road chainring sizes on it and kind of ride it on the road, and, you know, be able to use different tire sizes for gravel type of events. But then also it's a full-on cyclocross bike with, normally there's no way I want a front derailleur in cyclocross, because it just takes too much effort to shift it, and I just am happier with just a single chainring. But that, I think, is a pretty amazing thing about electronic, is that I could have the simplicity, shifting ease of just pushing a button and give me a bunch greater range of gears.
So it sounds to me like the answer is yes, you like it.
Yeah.
In the long and short of it.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, obviously, it's expensive and all that. But don't you
think it's going to start trickling down to, you know, maybe 105 and eventually electronic shifting? It's just going to get simpler and simpler as far as the, it may not be Durace quality, it never is, but I'm not sure that the technology won't get refined and come back down in price.
Yeah, I'm sure that's going to happen. And you know, I mean, it's, quite frankly, it's enjoyable as a bike mechanic having a new challenge.
Sure.
You know, I mean, it's like when cars went from distributors to electronic ignition, a lot of the mechanics just threw up their hands because now it was just a whole computerized thing. They threw up their hands and went to just working on brakes and mufflers. But a lot of them were like, whoa, this is cool, you know, a whole new challenge, and they wanted all the, you know, computer diagnostic stuff. And so I suspect it's going to be like that with the electronic, that there's going to be a lot of people that are going to be dragged there kicking and screaming, but there are going to be plenty that are, you know, and I'm talking now about mechanics in bike shops.
Right. Well, my partner was dragged kicking and screaming till he installed the first one, and then he was saved. You know, he was a convert. Yeah. It was just that as soon as he saw how it worked, it was just unbelievable. So what about disc brakes for road bikes? Is that happening? Is it going to happen? And what's happening with forks? Do you see the disc brakes for road bikes are going to really be a thing?
Well, I get lots of harassment about this because, you know, anytime there's something new, I mean, I was somebody who didn't think Camelback was going to go anywhere, and I was way wrong about that, but, you know, it's, like I say, I just am building up this bike for myself with disc brakes that's essentially a bike that I can use as a road bike and a cyclocross bike, and I'm intend to give it a full college try and all that, but it's an absolute must for mountain bikes. There's no question about that. It's fantastic. You know, I wouldn't have a mountain bike without disc brakes. And for cyclocross, I'm definitely up in the air. For Colorado dry conditions, it's, I don't really see that there's a big need for it, and I got a lot of wheels that don't have it. But for road, it adds weight to the bike, it adds aerodynamic drag to the bike, and we've been doing a number of bikes, you know, people have been ordering them with disc brakes, road bikes and touring bikes and kind of gravel racing bikes and cyclocross bikes, you know, with disc brakes. So we've been doing a lot of them, but my experience has been, you know, I'm a big guy and most of my customers are big, and the forks that are currently available, the carbon forks that are currently available, if you look at them, they look really beefy. When you look at them from the side, they're really wide, deep. But when you look at them from the front, they're super skinny. And what I've been finding is that it's really hard to avoid brake rub because there's so much lateral flex to those forks that the caliper's moving all over the place and, you know, rubbing the disc, which, you know, it's a drag on a mountain bike, but it's really a drag on a road bike.
Right.
You know, you just like that quietness of the bike, and they're going to get lighter. That's going to be a given, but you know, cable actuated disc brakes are certainly don't work as well as hydraulic disc brakes, or you would see them on high end mountain bikes. But a hydraulic disc brake, when you really reduce the size of the rotor, which you certainly will for road bikes, to make it lighter and less aerodynamic drag, and when you reduce the size of the caliper and the everything, then you have a lot less heat absorbing capacity in the system. And anybody that's had their disc brake fluid boil and know how then they suddenly don't have any brakes, because you know what's required for a hydraulic disc brake is that it's all fluid in there. If it turns to gas, it's just completely compressible, you know, and your levers pull to your bars and your bike doesn't stop. And I just can't see that not happening some on road bikes, you know, doing big massive descent on a hot day, lots of switchbacks on a heavy guy. little rotors, little brakes. I don't know. It just and right now the UCI only allows them for time trial bikes, and nobody's going to put them on a time trial bike because it's so unaerodynamic. And so, you know, one of the things that's if pro racers aren't using it, you know, we saw that with like the little tiny aero bars, the Cinelli Spinacci and stuff like that, that pro riders were using, and then the UCI banned them and it just killed the product. It just doesn't exist anymore.
Right.
And so there's that too. So I think if I were a betting man, I wouldn't bet my money that, especially within the next 5 years or something, that it was really going to take off on road bikes. I just, I mean, obviously I can't anticipate all the technology that's coming along. And, you know, I know that both SRAM and Shimano have these beautiful, beautiful hydraulic levers now that have hydraulic cylinders in them. And, you know, there's going to be some really beautiful brakes out there, but there's a lot of challenges to surmount before it really becomes something that everybody could feel safe and confident on, as well as have as light of a bike as they want.
Well, I wish we had another hour to talk, but I am actually fast running out of time. So here's what I'd like to request from you, that you and I have another conversation about the other things I wanted to talk about today. Is that a possibility in the not too distant future?
Sure.
Okay. Because I want to talk about things like sport touring bikes and are they coming back and crank arm length and all of that. But unfortunately, I'm fresh out of time. But it was really interesting to get to know you a little bit. So I enjoyed the conversation and I learned a lot, as I always do. So I am officially inviting you back to the show. Can we do that? Okay.
Sure.
Fine. That's great. So Leonard Zinn, the new edition of Zinn and the Art of Road Bike Maintenance. It should be available at your bike shop. You can get it from Velo Press online and zincycles.com.
Yes.
Zincycles.com. Z-I-N-N. Leonard, have a wonderful evening and thank you so much for joining me on the show.
You're welcome.
We'll talk again soon.
Okay.
All righty. Bye-bye. Leonard Zinn joined me from his home in Boulder, Colorado. It seems like it was an all Boulder show this evening. I hope you enjoyed it. I certainly enjoyed talking with our two guests this evening. Just great guys. Have a great week. It should be maybe a week to ride. And we'll be back next week, same time. We're also available on podcast at wjcu.org. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at wjcu.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at wjcu.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.